Hello, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction as well. Opposed to what was just said, everybody here loves trains, apparently. nice. But when I wanted to put this talk in the system, there were like all these kinds of tracks that you could choose, but there was no train tracks. So. So I had to like rewrite my talk a little bit to like hack it into the corner where I could give it. So I hacked it into the hardware track by saying that we are operating basically protocols on humans. And I will be comparing these humans to microservices as I know them from software. I don't know, let's just see where we head up. I know where we're going, but you don't. So a little bit about me. I've been for the first time to CCC in 33C3. That was the last time it was in Hamburg before it was in Hamburg again. So here are some pictures that hardly prove I've been here, but they were taken here as far as I remember. In my free time, I like to go climbing or make music. And in my non-free time, I'm a software developer at NS. NS is the Dutch Railways, but we call them Nederlandse Spoorwegen, so that's why I will probably be calling it NS a lot, because it's just engraved into my head. Where are we going? I wanted to basically just tell you everything about how the system works behind the scenes. But I wanted to make it interesting as well, so that's kind of what I already told you, but how I'm going to do it. I have to do the disclaimer that I've seen other people do here as well. I work for the Dutch Railways, but this talk is just going to be me talking about the stuff I've learned during my work there. I am going to talk a lot about stuff that I learned from my colleague Marco, who I want to specifically mention because he has actually been in like what we call operations and done the work of some of the people that I'm going to talk about. So he told me like basically everything I know right now. So if you're watching from home, thank you, Marco. Yeah. Nice. I'm going to compare the human architecture to microservice architecture. And I'm also going to share a little bit about the journey that I went through, because I'm just a software developer, which means that I had to learn in my 3 years now at NS how everything works by just interacting with everyone. For this talk, basically, I got a protocol of what happens when a train strands. Let me first tell you what that means. A train at an unplanned standstill. Travelers cannot disembark without assistance. So the train cannot move by itself anymore. It is probably broken. We don't have the Polish brand, which name I remember anymore. The Nevak. So it's probably not DRM. It's probably a real problem. And as you can see on this image, it's not beside a platform, so we cannot let the travelers go out. But we do want the travelers to get out at some point, because that's kind of the thing we are supposed to be doing. The word unplanned standstill is also important, because there's other trains, right? And those trains are probably also going to be influenced by this train not doing what it's supposed to be doing. So that's the case that we're going to look at. And like I said, I got a protocol from my colleague that basically described everything that everyone involved should be doing. As I tend to do when I get protocols, or usually it's software, but the protocol is just like a function, basically. Is I took it apart and I started like refactoring it until I understood it. So what we're going to go through now is like little, let's say, functions I took out of the whole protocol and try to show you in a way that it's comprehensible. So before we go on, I'm going to use this as my situation sketch. So the current situation is just this. The train that we saw on the picture, it's standing somewhere and there's not anything around it. So the first thing that's going to happen... let me back up. This is what a lot of the presentation is going to look like. These are called sequence diagrams. I know there's a lot of... let me just ask you, who has never seen a sequence diagram before? Oh, that's decent. Well, for the people at home and those three people that raised their hands. Sequence diagram, you read them from the top down, and often from left to right, but just follow the arrows and then you're fine. These contain a bunch of secret extra information. Like from a software perspective, I'm going to call all these people components. A component is like usually a container or some kind of runnable thing. And the boxes around them are services, which is like usually a grouping of components. So the thing, like the train, for example, in this talk will be a service, and then the train driver will be a component. So that's how you need to read this diagram. Even if you know sequence diagram, you maybe do not know the thing that I made up to structure it this way. And then there's one more secret piece of information, and it's the color of the heads of the people. I made all the people that work at the Dutch Railways blue, because yellow and blue are Dutch Railway. And then there's gray for what, in my eyes, is external. And it's usually ProRail. ProRail is, in the Netherlands, the company that manages basically the whole infrastructure. So that's NS does like the trains and the moving of people, and then ProRail does the train tracks. I looked this up. The thing above the train tracks. The catenary. Perfect. So remember that blue hats for NS, gray hat for ProRail. If you want to remember it. It's not super important, but it's a distinction that, like, as somebody works at NS, is important. So let's see. The train driver, we all know what that is, I think. He's going to call a guy in a traffic control post. Now, what is a traffic control post? I made an image for that. A traffic control post, we have 12 of them in the Netherlands, and they are, like, the level above trains, I guess, if you look at it as levels of abstraction. In each of these traffic control posts, each of them has an area that they are responsible for, and there will be people in there taking a look at that area and constantly looking at, is everything going according to plan in here? And the people that work in the traffic control posts are actually able to turn like the traffic lights, basically, for trains to red or to green. So this is people job still in the Netherlands, at least. And then there was a third thing in the first diagram I showed you, and that's the central monitoring center. This is one for all of the Netherlands that has like more of a eagle eye view on the whole situation. And there's a bunch of different groups in here that I'm not all gonna name. But they are on a different kind of level, on a national level. And interestingly, this image, it contains people from ProRail and people from NS, like the people that really need to be close to each other. They are literally close to each other. So let's go back to the diagram. We got our train driver. He basically calls to the traffic control post, hey, my train broke down. And the traffic control post basically calls to the central center saying, hey, this train broke down. And then they create a dossier in SporeWeb. SporeWeb we're going to see like a lot, basically in every diagram. It is the one system that everybody involved will always look at for information and also can enter information, usually. So we can already do take some notes of what kind of architecture we're looking at here, right? So we've seen different kinds of components. Train drivers, they have a whole bunch of replicas, usually one per train. And then the control post, they have only 12 replicas, and actually the national post, they have only one. And a lot of the components in there also only have one replica. This implies some kind of hierarchical structure, not necessarily a power structure, but there's like a national level and a not national level. So these subcomponents are geo-based. And we've seen a communication channel, and that's the phone. And you could say there's maybe a second communication channel also with SporeWeb, of course. So stuff needs to happen, and the first things that are going to be put into motion are response teams. There's a few different ones of them, so I'll just show all of them. I'm not going to go into too much detail about this, but there's an NS control room, and they are responsible for safety of travelers. So they are put into action, and they have a guidance team that does passenger support, and they're going to send them to the train. And as you see, again, SporeWeb is like the central place. So they get their information from there, they do something, and then they log into SporeWeb, like, we're sending a passenger support team. Technical response is going to go basically the same way. They get some kind of alert based on that there's a new SporeWeb dossier. They're going to send their technical response team. And they're also going to call up the driver to see if they can already do some immediate investigation of the defect, and then they're going to log that into SporeWeb. So unfortunately, I thought I would be the only one to have this joke slide, but I've already seen it in an earlier presentation. This is what the phone call will look like to the train driver. it's actually really, they probably won't even have to call about this. This is really the first thing that we do if a train stops working. We just turn it off and on again and hope that that fixes it. And then there's a third kind of response team, and that's the incident response team. This is a ProRail team that goes to any kind of incidents around the track. And this is basically a service of two components. The incident control is a bunch of different people that are like the hands. And then there's the incident supervisor, which is the brains. He's going to go to the incident, and he's also going to take over responsibility of the train service controller from the traffic control post. So if you remember, the traffic control post is like the thing we have 12 for around the whole country. But of course, 12 in the Netherlands. Netherlands is not big, but you cannot like see all of the tracks from your traffic control post. So the incident supervisor and the train service controller, they are going to define an area of responsibility, and the incident supervisor says, well, if I arrive at that area of responsibility, nothing is going to happen unless I say so. So no trains get to enter that area, no trains get to leave that area, and also if some kind of help services arrive or something, they will go to the incident supervisor about anything. So this is our situation sketch right now. It's becoming a little bit more complicated already, but it's manageable, I think. The red thing is the area of responsibility. The train is still just the train. And we can do some new notes on how does this architecture work. We have three different components that are basically doing kind of the same thing, right? It's all a response team. They have clearly defined different responsibilities. One is responsible for the travelers, one is responsible for the physical train, and then there's one responsible for basically everything else. And from a software perspective, these response teams are jobs. So if you know, services are the things that are constantly running, and jobs, you spin them up when you need them, and then they do something, and then they, I don't want to say die, but they... yeah, terminate's not better, right? they exit. But so these, the weird thing is, these jobs constantly take up resources. We have to have this team ready even if there's no incidents, right? We need to have these teams ready beside their car or whatever they're going to use to get to the incident. And this is probably a good moment, by the way, because I wanted to do this at the beginning, but I have major respect for all the people that I'm talking about in this talk. So I'm not doing this talk to say like we should have automated everything and computers are better than humans, which is probably a slide that we might still end up at. But seriously, like if anyone here does any of the jobs that I'm talking about, well done. It's not easy jobs usually. It requires like really high tolerance of stress because when something happens, you have to react in that moment, and people are waiting for you, and like hundreds of people are waiting for you probably inside that train that does nothing. Right. So just to be clear, I don't want to put these people in a bad light or anything. I'm just looking at how it works in a way that I understand. Okay, so let's just go on and see what the next thing is, what's happening. So we have these three response teams. They have to get to location. What else can we do in the meantime while they're not necessarily there yet? We need to know more about this train. We don't have a lot of electronic systems that tell us how many people there are in the train. In Germany, you have like a lot of reservation systems, I think. You can reserve an actual seat in an actual train. In the Netherlands, you cannot. And because everybody uses an electronic chip at their place of departure that they use again where they arrive, we have no idea what they're doing in between until they've arrived. And then still, we don't know exactly which train they took sometimes. So we just need to call again. We need to call the conductor, and we will ask them how many people are in the train. And then we'll add those details also again to SporeWrap. And as you can see, these are like similar people to the ones before that were, or the same people actually as the ones before that are responsible for travelers. And of course, all the information gets locked into SporeWrap again, because that's, well, you've probably seen the pattern. We're going to do a second thing as well. Remember that I said it's unplanned, right? So there's other trains. There's probably other trains that want to use these tracks where this train is now standing still. So the traffic control post, about this, they still have the power, even though there was the boundary where the traffic control post has no power. They are going to talk amongst themselves first about the situation as we have it, and then they're going to communicate a capacity allocation. So in this case, they're probably going to say, like, okay, this one track, there's a train there, so we cannot use it. The other track, we probably need it for safety. Like, if people are going to be exiting this train, there should not be other trains speeding past at 100 kilometers an hour. So let's just say we cannot have any trains on that other track as well. And there could be more tracks, and then they would say, like, maybe 50% of the normal amount of trains is allowed to go past. So that's what these guys on the left are saying, and then they communicate that to the national traffic coordinator, and they are going to make a diversion measure. And a diversion measure basically means that they will say, okay, if we're not allowed to use these tracks that I beautifully crossed out, then the trains that want to go past these tracks, they should not go there. So in this case, the image I took was of a high-speed train, so it actually has quite a few stops. So what would happen is that at Schiphol Airport, all the way on the top, we're going to say, well, any of these trains that comes there, it just goes back, and it pretends to be another train. And any train that arrives at Rotterdam, it also just goes back. At this, it's quite fun, these diversion measures. We have a lot of them already ready for any situation that could occur. It's like, I don't know, thousands probably. So they basically just pick it off a shelf, check if it's pliable enough, and then they do it. There's also a quick architecture note. We've seen a new communication channel. If we go back a little bit. These guys that are in the same service, they were able to use, well, they're not actually using a megaphone, but they are talking to each other. They don't need a phone, because in this case, at least, the service is also physically located at the same spot. So that's interesting. Now, the last thing that we need to do before we can actually evacuate the people is have something to evacuate them into. But hey, there's new people here. Let's take a quick look at who they are. There's a regional control center. And these people have blue hats, as opposed to the traffic control posts that have gray hats. And they are kind of, I call them mirrored. Like there's regional control centers for talking to the traffic control posts, but they are from NS. And there's less of them, because only looking at trains, apparently you need less. So currently there's five, there might be four next year. And they are spread over the Netherlands in a similar way. So these are going to talk about, the traffic controller is going to call them, but probably they already know because they look at SporeWeb all day long. And then they are going to think about like, okay, we need the evacuation train. What do you need for an evacuation train? A rolling stock, that's what we call the physical trains. And we need personnel to drive it. So that's what all the blue-headed people are going to do, because that's trains. But we also need the gray-headed person to organize the fact that we can move the train from A to B, because the evacuation train is never where you already need it to be. It's usually somewhere else. So we need a path, and that's what ProRail basically does. They need to make sure that there's a path between all the other already planned trains. So that's the way that these three systems work together for that. Oh, yeah, we also have, for the personnel, we have also a different service and a different component. This is the National Personnel Coordinator. So they are going to make sure that there's a driver. And again, we can do some architectural conclusions. There's different services for rolling stock and personnel. It's actually quite nice, architecturally speaking. These regional control centers, they have deterministic mapping to the traffic control post, but they are less. We need less of them. And they had smaller areas of responsibility in the busier areas, so around Utrecht and Amsterdam and like the big cities in the Netherlands. Yeah, they have smaller areas so that they can keep track of like the trains there. There's also a fun fact: failover is possible. So if somebody's missing from one of the regional control centers, especially the coordinating roles, they fail over by having somebody in another regional control center doing that job, which is, I don't know, feels kind of weird to me, because they don't have the advantage of being physically in the same place. So probably because the regional control centers also have this speaking communication channel, that probably also then changes to a phone channel. But it's cool that it exists. So apparently it's foolproof. Now let's fast forward in time. This is the last one, by the way. After this, you can forget most of the sequence diagram stuff. We're going to talk about something else. But this is a big one, so it's going to take some time anyway. We fast forward in time. All the response teams have arrived at the location. An evacuation train has been managed somehow. It also has to get there, of course. And because the incident supervisor is now at location, the boundary that I told you about earlier, it has taken effect, and the incident supervisor will be the boss around there. So if there's like emergency services around, they will also be managing those. And let's say that the evacuation train arrives. So that's the one in the bottom there. It arrives at the boundary, and there will be like a red light. It has to stop, and until the incident supervisor says that it's okay, it has to wait there. So that's the first thing that we see. The first arrow that we see is allowing the train to enter the boundary. And then the train service controller is still the person that sets the traffic light to green. Then it will tell the team, the incident control team, okay, it's cool, we can start the evacuation. They will log the start of the evacuation in SporWeb. Evacuation happens. They will log the completion of the evacuation. I also had a new situation sketch. So they entered, right? That's I forgot that I had this slide. One important thing is this whole process of getting the evacuation train material, driver, and getting the train there, we have to do it again for a drag train, because the situation sketch that we have now is that this train cannot move by itself, so another train also has to go there. It has to drag away the train that stood still. The drag train and the evacuation train are not allowed to be the same train. Because that, I don't know, went terribly wrong somehow, sometime. not terribly wrong, but I don't remember the exact anecdote, but it wasn't nice, so we don't do that anymore. It's also like we want to drag the broken train to a different location than that the people want to go, right? So that's also a factor here. After this, basically, we check for a while if everything is fine, and then the SporWeb dossier also can close. Fun architecture note. The channel between the incident supervisor and the incident control has changed. First they had a phone channel, but now that they're physically in the same location, they also have the megaphone. So apparently they can do that. They can just change communication channels. This, after my whole analysis of the protocol, is the architecture that I wound up with. It's possible that there are like a few arrows here that were not in the sequence diagrams that you've seen, and that would have been the case because of simplification and maybe refactoring errors. But it's already kind of dry material, and I didn't want to make it more boring for you guys. So this is the architecture that we end up with. And to me, it was actually a bit surprising, because it looks... I'm not a software architect, but to me this looks kind of okay. Like, most components only have one arrow to one other component, and that's, I think, what you want, because if you would have too many arrows to too many different components, then nobody knows who needs to talk to whom. The only thing is that I left out SporWeb in this whole thing, because it would have been all arrows to SporWeb, and you would not have been able to read a thing. And one interesting piece to note is the kind of circular arrows going on between the traffic controller, the operational coordinator, and the hub coordinator. So the way the system is designed, the traffic controller is kind of the boss of the train service controller. They'll probably not appreciate me saying that. But there's like one traffic controller and several train service controllers. And then on the other, on the NS side, there is the operational coordinator, who is kind of the boss, but not the boss of the HIP coordinator. And it's supposed to be the way that the traffic controllers talk to the operational coordinators, and then among themselves, they sort their stuff out. And sometimes the HIP coordinator can talk to the train service controllers, but in this case, I'm told this is an exception. The HIP coordinator is allowed to talk to the traffic controller because it just goes faster that way. We can simplify this if we take out the components and only look at the services. So that makes it a bit easier to understand. We now see that there is also a talking channel between services, which is interesting. My first inclination would be that that's only possible within the service, but because the incident response physically relocates to the train, which is also a thing that we don't know much about in software development. The communication channel also there can change to whatever is most efficient, probably. Okay, so what have we learned? A lot, I hope. We have seen three different types of connections. The phone channel, the shouting channel, and then the SporWeb logging. We've seen an architecture with responsibility-based separation, so mostly like stuff like personnel and trains and tracks and incidents. They all have their own components or services that are about that. Some components function like services, which are running all the time. And by that, I mean, by the way, really all the time. So there's like 3 8-hour shifts every day. And others are more like jobs, which are also 3 8-hour shifts every day, but they're not always on their maximum capacity of working, let's put it like that. A redundancy is built in a way for most of these services. Not so much for the central services, but they usually have failovers where like one container or one person does the job of two containers, basically. Now, this is the part of the talk where I get to talk about what I've learned. Humans versus machines. What we've seen is that so the protocol I got was 3 to 4 pages, I think. So the tasks for the humans, they probably had a job description that's longer than that, but it leaves room for interpretation, and the humans are allowed to do that, which makes them highly adaptable, and it makes it possible to basically vibe code. Humans can physically relocate to improve their functioning, and humans have a very good speech interface, and also a pretty decent text interface, it seems, through SporWeb. So they are pretty cool. I have not. I've not seen a human run Doom yet, so maybe one of you can work on that. And then the machine versus humans. I also kind of love machines because their task interpretation difference between humans. So I've spoken to a lot of people that technically have the same role within the company, but one of them says like, yeah, I need to check personnel details and this and that, and the other one says like, personnel is not part of my job description. And it's like, well, you both have the same job, so. The interesting thing is that also if you were to update software on a machine, you can delete the old version of the software and you can install the new version of the software, right? Try that on a human and they will be like, yesterday you told me to do this and now you tell me to do that. And they don't like it. So that's a big advantage of machines. That's the second point. Editing code is a lot easier than editing humans. If any of you works on software, remember that. It's like the most important lesson I've had in the last couple of years as well. Like, you can try to convince somebody, like, you're not supposed to press that button and then that button. Just change the way the buttons work. And machines are great at talking to other machines. So that's good. They're not that super great at talking to humans. We know all about that. Let's see if I have anything in my notes that I haven't told you guys yet. Yeah, so what have we really learned at the end of this journey? This system and environment are super complex. Like, when I started at NS, I thought, like, we can do everything with computers. It turns out we cannot. And that's why we need so many humans to do the jobs that they are doing. And like I said before, these jobs in this day and age, at least in the Netherlands, are still super important, because just physically, like, especially for example, for such a person as the incident coordinator, like, physically going to a location, seeing the situation, being able to talk to everyone involved, that is a super important thing that we can never, I think, let a machine do. Maybe not never, but we shouldn't want it. What we do have to do, if like somebody in management of NS is in this room, or maybe ever watches my talk, we should be improving our software so that these humans have a smaller or simpler or more fun task to do. So that's also why I like my job, basically, because that's what I get to do. I think that the architecture of the contact between the humans is actually relatively elegant. The whole system I've just explained to you will probably be outdated in at least half a year, because there's a development cycle of around a year for this system, so it changes, it keeps changing, which is, like, for me, a year development cycle would be terrible, but for a system like this, is, I think, quite decent, and we can keep improving it, which is nice. Also, like, the way it is set up, it allows for small changes. We can take, like, one component and turn it into two components or something, and we do need to change, like, a whole bunch of protocols, but we can do a small change and then see if it works. So that's basically it. I didn't have a question slide, but this is the moment where we can do questions.
So, thank you so much, Martin, for giving us this insight. Before I go to the questions, I see there are already a lot of questions in the room. Chaos Carrier has asked me to shout out if Paella is in this room. Is someone with the nick Paella here? You might also use the nick Celestial Synapse. If you are in this room, please just come to me after the talk. Thank you. Or if some of you knows the person, then you can also approach me. So I will start with microphone one.
Thank you for the nice talk. Thank you. Well, I saw on a map a location that I never, as a passenger, heard of before. It's around Rotterdam. It was Kijkhoek. And I was whispered here that it was not a passenger train, but for freight trains. Is it?
That's a very...
Yeah, there it was. Kijkhoek.
Kijkhoek, yeah. Kijkhoek. I had also never heard of it before, and... Sorry, I'm going to answer your question with I don't know. Mm-hmm. But a fun fact about this is this is actually the application I work on. We do, like, a map of where are all the trains. And we usually show, like, big cities with the little signs like these. I had to hack in the code for Kijkhoek, because it didn't exist in our application either. But it's sounds very plausible that it is mostly for industrial trains. It could be that there also are passenger trains in the area that Kaifhoek does, but that they just don't stop there, because the trains moving through the area are just as important as trains stopping in an area. So that could also be a reason why you don't know it, but I'm not entirely sure.
Oh, that wasn't actually my question. My question was...
That's a problem, because we have a lot of questions, so try to have it short.
So if, in case this isn't a passenger point, are there ever evacuation moments, and do they skip that then and bring out the drag train immediately?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, so it's possible that the train breaks down that has no people in it, and then you don't have to evacuate.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Short questions, short answers. Then
it's a shunting station. I just heard. I'm sorry,
all right.
I can't repeat that.
Thank you for the comments from the audience. I would give over to microphone two.
Yes, thank you. It was a great talk. I was curious about the pre-planned alternative schedules in case something goes wrong in points. Like, how detailed are there? Like, is it like specific timetables of, okay, like we can slot this train at this time at this route, or is it more open that people figure it out when it happens?
It is, as far as I know, the concept variants are mostly a train series. So I think Germany has this concept more than the Netherlands. A train series is like a numbered train. And you have a bunch of those a day. So the train between, Amsterdam and Maastricht is always, I'm making up this number, 43 something, 43 11, 43 15. And then they will look up, like, so the diversion measure that will say, like, okay, we cancel train 43 something, and then we still do 53 something.
All right, but it's just cancellation and not like, okay, we make this train route just go onto a different track than normal.
They usually do not do that for like temporary problems like that. So train, really circumventing trains. In the Netherlands, as far as I know, I could be wrong, but it mostly only happens when it's planned. If there's a planned maintenance or something, we would reroute.
I see. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Microphone three, please. You are.
Hey, thank you. I'm reassured to know that the train system is run by nerds like us. That's very comforting. If you have to evacuate people onto a track without a replacement train, how does your system handle that? Do you ever have to deal with that?
Sorry, can you repeat one more time?
Don't have a replacement evacuation train and you have to put passengers directly onto the track, how does your system deal with that? What changes?
I think we would prioritize canceling a train and evacuating somebody with a train over not canceling another train. So if there's no materials, if there's no materials available, we will just cancel a train so that that material becomes available.
I was thinking more about if you have no other trains at all, and or you can't get one close enough, and the passengers on the train have to step down onto the adjacent track, how does your system deal with you now have people on the track? Does this change anything?
So, well, we will definitely make sure that the track is like not accessible for trains if there would be people on it. But it's really, really something that we try to prevent. Because, like, for example, jumping out of a train on the tracks, people do it in movies, but if you would do it in reality, you would probably break a leg. That's like, so it's really dangerous for people to go onto the tracks, and we really don't want it. So we would do everything that we can to not do it. And if we would really, really, really have to, we would probably have, like, I don't know, special stairs and then special guidance and no trains in the area.
Microphone four, please.
Thanks for the talk. I was wondering if there are human communication protocols between the traffic control posts in the Netherlands that are still used, or is it all digital in regards to signaling?
In regards to signaling, as in changing the what I've been calling traffic lights, or
As in changing the traffic lights and informing another traffic control post that they have a train on the way to them.
Oh well, so there's I've never done these jobs, so I cannot answer with full certainty. But there is a crazy amount of telephonic contact. So In my architecture that I drew up, the lines are just what are in the protocol. There are probably way more lines than that outside of the protocol. People can call like a lot of other people, and they will, because their job, like, these are not people that have, a fear of calling other people like some of us may have. They will just call anyone for anything. But the changing the signals will happen, I think, digitally. I've seen countries that have human-operated, like basically buttons next to the track to change signals. I don't think we have those anywhere anymore.
Thank you. Microphone 5, please.
Thank you for a really interesting talk. This follows on to the sort of communications thing here. There's a lot of telephony happening in your system. Is it traditional sort of like, and this is maybe a user experience question, is it traditional sort of like pick up the phone and dial someone thing, or is it sort of like more push to talk, hey, I've got something going on happening in your system?
They will have an application on their computer that basically says which role they want to call, and then they click it, and then they pick up the phone.
Okay.
There's no manual dialing, but also no...
So intercom type thing.
Sorry?
Like an intercom almost.
No, it is really like phone communication. But
okay.
You just choose who you want to call, and then you call them like a normal phone call.
Cool, thanks.
All right, microphone 6, please.
So the process sounds similar to the process in Germany, so I was wondering about the overall time frame, because in Germany we hear these horror stories of hours and hours it takes to evacuate a train.
We have officially a rule that people need to have been evacuated within an hour. We also have a rule that everybody should have a seating place even during rush hour. So. But as far as I know, this one, like, we do usually get to do it within an hour, but it really depends, right? Because if it is rush hour, it's harder to get available material in the right spot in the right time. If an evacuation needs to happen on a bridge, I asked someone about this, and they said, yeah, the train should really not stop on a bridge. So it could become more difficult. And then there's like the really special situation is we have one train that goes from Amsterdam Central Station to England, and people have technically left the Netherlands as soon as they entered that train. So when they have to evacuate, they have to somehow re-enter the Netherlands and do border control. And that's those usually take longer than an hour to happen, because they really rather fix the train than have to do that.
Then from the cyberspace, please, the question.
The internet asks, Netherlands is smaller and maybe less underfunded, but apart from what can Deutsche Bahn learn from NS to improve?
I have not worked for Deutsche Bahn, so I don't know much about the Deutsche Bahn internals. I know we like to talk nasty about the Deutsche Bahn a lot, because our numbers are better. Like, on paper we perform a lot better. I do know also that one reason why on paper we perform that well is that we have trains that go the same route every 10 minutes. It's almost like a subway network, some people say. So if one train has a 10-minute delay, we cancel the train. We say, you just get the next one. It's already there. So you will not see, you will not often see a Dutch NS train that has like a 2-hour delay, because there has been, quick math, 11 trains already that would have done the same track. Whereas like the ICE I took to get here, there would be one 3 hours later or something if I missed this one. So I don't know, what could the Deutsche Bahn learn? Have fun with your time bookkeeping is one, and I really can't say what they could learn from a software development perspective, because I don't know how it works.
So, if we are all now very disciplined, have short questions, short answers, I think I can go through all the microphones one more time. So I start with one.
Okay, thanks for the look behind the scenes. So NS has an API that exposes, among other things, train breakdowns. By the way, nice home assistant integration for those who are interested. So when does the communication towards that API happen? As soon as the information is logged about the breakdown into SportWeb, does it get exposed automatically to the API, or is there some other intermediate step?
Short answer, I don't know, because I didn't know this API existed. I would suspect maybe ProRail has this API. Are you sure it's NS?
That's possible. It's called NS API, but...
Oh, that's probably NS. I'm sorry, I don't know, and we were doing two short answers, so...
Thank you.
Number two, please.
So thanks from my side. A short question about escalation. It reminds me a lot of incident response planning for cybersecurity incidents. How do you escalate? Which positions can escalate? For example, if a tree is on the track and you can't get there otherwise, how do you escalate?
How do you escalate if a tree is on the tracks?
I mean, for some problems, you have a bigger scope than just an incident response flame. You have, for example, crisis response at some point. But who can say we have a crisis now and not just an incident?
Yeah, I'm going to have to say I don't know again. I'm not sure. It's outside of the protocol that I read for this talk.
All right, then microphone three, please.
Hello, thank you very much. With your expertise, what do you think, how far are we away from an autonomous railway system?
Oof. Well, you could have an autonomous railway system if you take it, if you build it completely separate from the non-autonomous railway system, I think. So if you build like one rail, between two places, and you keep all of this other stuff disconnected from it, yeah, you could probably run it automated. If you also keep the humans out of there, it's probably fine. So more serious answer, I really don't think it's gonna happen in my time working at NS or any time, maybe not even in our lives, but it's all like, looking at the future, right? Who knows?
Number four.
Thanks for the talk. I was wondering if operators like Arriva and Keolis would use the same rolling stock as NS when evacuations need to happen on like shared tracks near south of Limburg.
Probably not. We don't share the tracks that much, and managing or getting material and personnel for an evacuation train is done by the, in this case, by the NS people in the regional center. So they only know about NS material and NS personnel. I don't know if, like, you could probably ask for help in a super serious situation or something, right? But as far as I know, there's no protocol for that, and it would be unique, I think.
All right, thank you.
I'm not entirely sure. It could be different the other way around, because sometimes, because NS operates like over 80% of the railway network, sometimes NS does a bit more than the other, like Arriva and the other providers do.
Thank you.
Number 5, please.
Yeah, bedankt for the good talk.
Alsjeblieft.
How does the architecture look like if NS or NS International must talk with Deutsche Bahn because like of a broken down train in Odense, because like the ECE Twinio has broken down or something? How does it look like from the perspective of the NS?
I'm gonna quickly go back to here. Short answer again, I don't know. But I would imagine there would be like two more of these systems, or two more of these enterprises, right? Deutsche Bahn, I looked it up before the talk, but I'm not entirely sure I understood it. Deutsche Bahn is a bit different in the split between ProRails and Dutch Railways as we have them, because Deutsche Bahn has a like sub organization, if I understood correctly, that also does the infrastructure. So maybe there would be like one more enterprise and a bunch of services in there, but maybe it's still like in secret two enterprises and.
They change responsibility at the border. The ICE trains are operated by NS.
Where is the voice they, coming from?
No, sorry, I heard it. They change responsibility at the border. So as soon as they cross the border, Deutsche Bahn will have responsibility.
All right. Thank you. Then we have time for 1 and 5 again, but no additional question, please.
So thank you for the talk. Listening to it and comparing it to the operations at DB was quite interesting, and now I'm interested in a flow diagram for DB. And I have a question. On your map, you showed that the rescue train for the passengers was on the same track as the broken down train. Is that like that in real life or just a graphical thing? Because the passengers would probably have to get out of the train, right, so to get to the other. So is that like really this track is blocked, we can't go there, or is it really that the train actually goes next to the other? Because in Germany, at least with the long distance trains, I think they will try to pull up a train next to the one and just get the passengers over with bridges.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think you're absolutely right. And I think this slide is wrong. And actually, after I made this slide and I was ready to go to bed, I showed it to my partner and she said, I don't think that's right. So probably we do exactly the same thing, and I just drew. So imagine that this doesn't say evacuation can happen, but dragging the train away can happen, and then it would look like this.
Thank you.
All right, and the final question from microphone 5.
How much resources are available for evacuation and towing vehicles? Because as I remember, in Germany we have some, at the hubs we have ready equipment for not evacuation, but for towing vehicles, and the evacuation is sometimes chaotic because they try to evacuate a train with a full another train because they don't have the time to kick the people out who aren't in are already in the evacuation train. How is there any stock rolling stock sitting around in depot for such events?
That's a good question, and interesting to hear that that's the way it happens here.
Yeah, sometimes, like if they don't have enough and it has to go fast. Yeah.
So like I said earlier, it's a little bit easier, I think, to cancel a train in the Netherlands because we have, if we cancel a train, chances are like. Worst case, somebody has to wait for half an hour for the next same train. So that's usually what we do. Like we cancel the train, we free up a rolling stock that way if necessary. And it really depends on the time of day, whether it's necessary or not, because during rush hour, basically all available rolling stock will be part of a train somewhere in the Netherlands, except for the rolling stock that's already in repair. But outside of rush hour, we have a lot of rolling stock that's just standing around somewhere, because outside of rush hour, we need to move less people.
Apart from the rolling stock, the people like who drive the train conductors, who drive the train.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So there are a bunch
I'm
of people sitting around.
I'm very sorry. Can you, like our counter has gone down. So for any other questions, I guess you can still approach Martin at the Congress for more train nerdery. Thank you so much for all your questions, for being so engaged in this talk. Let's thank our speaker.